The scripture reading this morning will be taken from Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15. Deuteronomy 18, verse 15. And it says, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen, to him you shall listen."
Good morning. Thank you so much for being here this morning. I want to thank the elders for providing this opportunity, Scott for reaching out, and for all of you participating. Thank you for the class period. You were very enthusiastic. Maybe didn't have a whole lot of questions. I guess I just answered them all as I taught. That's not true. So if you have questions this week about anything that I say, please feel free to ask. I mean, I'm here for you this week. I've got a couple of long-distance studies that I need to do during the course of the day between now and Wednesday, but I can work around those. So I'm here for you. If you want to get together for breakfast, for coffee, for lunch, I'm here for you. Please make use of me. It has been a long time since I have preached in Ohio. Years ago, our family lived for a short period of time in Amelia, and I worked with the New Richmond congregation right on the river, and we were there. Shortly after that, we moved over to Indianapolis, and we were there for 8 years, working with the congregation there. My brother and sister-in-law are still there. Most recently, Anna and I moved up from Birmingham. We were down in Birmingham with the Cahaba Heights congregation for 5 years. So I'm looking forward to getting to know all of you. Some of you I know a little bit, and hopefully we'll get to know you better. Just for the sake of convenience, to answer a couple of your questions while I've got you in one spot, right? A lot of people will ask, so what are you doing? Where are you coming from? So let me just take a couple of minutes and explain that. I was preaching down at Cahaba Heights in Birmingham, Alabama, as recently as the fall of 2019. And towards the end of that year, we knew at the beginning of the year, but towards the end of the year, we had to move. My mother, who is only in her early 60s, has been battling congestive heart failure for almost a decade. And I have a brother my parents adopted out of due season. I have a 17-year-old brother who, 27-year difference, you know, he's younger than my oldest son. As Tom Hanks jokes, like, we are your typical American family. So in 2019, because of Mom's health condition and because of my brother, you know, being that much younger at that time, we decided that we needed to live closer to my parents to support my mom and dad. And as an evangelist, you know how that goes. You don't always get to pick where you go to preach. You know, you go where the Lord needs you. And so for most of 2019, we looked for a congregation that was in my parents' backyard, and there just wasn't one. I mean, the closest one to us at the time would have put us 2 hours away from my parents, a four-hour round trip, and it just wasn't practical. And so as 2019 wore on, one of my elders came up to me, and he's like, "I want to pitch an idea to you." And I was like, "Well, pitch it." And he said, "Have you ever thought about becoming a non-located evangelist?" And I said, "A what?" And he said, "You know, a non-located evangelist." And I'm like, "Keep talking." And he said, "If the support was there, would you keep doing personal Bible studies?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Would you continue doing biblical counseling?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Would you keep doing gospel meetings?" And I said, "Yep." And he said, "Would you continue doing overseas work if you had opportunity? And would you keep doing Appia Media work?" And I was like, "Yes, yes, yes, yes." And he said, "If you have the support, do you have to be in the pulpit every week?" And I was like, "Well, try pitching that to other people." And I was like, "You know, that's really sweet. I'm not super comfortable with that. Thanks, but no thanks." And every couple of weeks, he's like, "Hey, I have this idea. Hey, I have this idea." And so it took him 3 months. He wore me down over 3 months. And what the congregation in Cahaba did is they said, "We love this idea. We love you. We will support you through the end of 2019, full support, move." And then use that time to try to raise support to be a non-located evangelist. So I am a non-located evangelist. I'm not in the pulpit on a typical Sunday anymore. I worship with the congregation in Eastland in Louisville. They have a located evangelist that they fully support. His name is Scott Byer, and he does a fantastic job. But try being a non-located evangelist moving to town. hey, I'm here. I'm not trying to horn in on your deal, but I'm here. So for the last 3.5 years, that's what I've been doing. Mom's health took a serious hit last year. Things got to the point where we had to move in with my parents. So my parents and I share a house. I boomeranged in my 40s. I thought it'd be much later. But, you know, I'm not even a millennial. I'm Gen X. So that's what I'm doing. For the foreseeable future, for the next couple of years, you know, my younger brother, Lord willing, will graduate high school next year. He's going into his senior year. And we're grateful that Mom's health is stable for the moment. So that's what I'm doing. And thank you for the couple of minutes to explain that. If you have more questions about that, I'll answer those this week. Now, getting to the topic at hand, talking about Moses and these segments from his life. Really, as I sat down and started outlining this, there are more segments that we can include. And hopefully as we go through the series of studies, you'll understand what I mean by that. Like, it's super easy to look at the book of Exodus and break down segments and go, yeah, that's the outline. But there's a specific way we're breaking it down that I hope you'll see and appreciate. And you'll have some aha moments. But to start with, we're going to talk about the deliverer's birth. We're going to talk about the birth of Moses. And so if you're in your Old Testament, you're going to want to be, you know, in those couple of pages wrapping up Genesis, starting Exodus. Because to tell the story of Moses, you have to tell the story of Joseph. You have to explain how Moses' family wound up in Egypt when that's not where they're from. And so as you conclude the book of Genesis, you understand the providential care that God used to preserve the life of that family of 70 during a period of extreme famine when other people around the world were starving. You know, God made sure there was food in Egypt and moved that family to Egypt. And he didn't put them in a barren place. He put them in a place that was lush and green and that would take care of their flocks. And so you have a period of approximately 300 to 350 years between the close of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus where Joseph's family is living life. And they're having kids and they're expanding and they're growing. And we have to talk a little bit about the politics around that time too. Right? And I know this is kind of small, but on the side of the screen there, you're looking at an aerial map of Egypt. And it's so confusing to call it Lower and Upper Egypt when you do the north-south thing. Okay? So Lower Egypt is north, Upper Egypt is south. Take it up with the historians. Typically, Upper Egypt, Southern Egypt, was wealthier. They had a lot. Like when you go and you tour Egypt today, the gorgeous stuff, all of the temples and the idols, Karnak and all that stuff, that's down at Luxor. You go south. You go to Upper Egypt. Now, when we think of Egypt, we think pyramids, we think Sphinx and that kind of stuff. That is Lower Egypt. That's up in the Nile Delta area. And when you're talking about Exodus, geographically, it primarily focuses on Lower Egypt. It's up in the Nile Delta area. The land of Goshen is up there. But to talk about politics, we get this, and if you want copies of this, I'm sure the guys will freely share PowerPoint with you. But you're looking at a timeline that runs from the bottom to the top of the slide. So at the bottom of the slide, you have approximately 1800 BC. At the top of the slide, you have approximately 1200 BC, and going by 100-year increments. Okay, and when you look at the black tower or column that goes up through there, it's breaking it down into historical periods. The Middle Kingdom, Second Intermediate Period, and the New Kingdom, followed by the dynasties of the pharaohs, 12th Dynasty, 13th Dynasty, 15th and 16th, 18th and 19th at the top. And trying to figure out where does the Exodus fit as far as secular history goes, that's been a topic that's been debated for a long time. I mean, you will find people that place, like, who's the pharaoh? Because he's not given a name. It's just a pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph's family. Well, which pharaoh? And they're trying to piece it together. Like I said, you can watch other documentaries. You can look at other videos. Some people for a long time speculated that the Exodus must have taken place around 1200, somewhere in the 1200s. More recently, I think it's more reasonable that it's the mid-1400s. I'll I'll make a little brief case for that for just a second. So in that time period, between about 1600 and 1500, you know, leading up to the 1400s, you had something really interesting happening in the land of Egypt between lower and upper. And what was taking place was there were some kings that came down from the Phoenician area, from the Canaan area, and they came down in the Nile Delta area and they conquered it, but they were not native Egyptians. But they wanted to be perceived as Egyptian, and so they co-opted a lot of the Egyptian religion, a lot of the Egyptian literature, a lot of the Egyptian, they wanted to be seen as deity, right? They wanted to stake a claim and say, we are fulfilling all the prophecies and all this stuff. Those rulers were called the Hyksos. And they reigned primarily in the Nile Delta area in Lower Egypt. What that meant was the native Egyptians down in the southern area in Upper Egypt, you basically had two competing Egypts. One was native, one was not. And those Hyksos rulers reigned for several hundred years until they were defeated and kicked out. And then Egypt was unified again. And when that process took place, there was a cultural cleansing. The native Egyptians started going through and demolishing the monuments and removing the records of these Hyksos rulers. So they were trying to remove them from cultural memory. Now we have fragments of some of that, but not as much as we ought to have because it was all gotten rid of, right? Now on your chart, your timeline, about right in the middle on your far right, you've got this expulsion of the Hyksos that happened in the early 1500s. That likely happened just prior to Moses' birth. And so you need to make some connections. If this is all accurate, you have these Canaanite Phoenician rulers that have taken over the Delta area, and they've been seen as the enemy, defeated and driven out. But what's left in the land is another family that looks Canaanite that came from that area, and it's Joseph's descendants. And so there arose a Pharaoh who knew not Joseph, but you've got a massive population on one of your borders that is somewhat related to the people you just kicked out. And you automatically do not like them, you're suspicious of them, and you want to control them. Does that make sense? You're not going to read that in Exodus 1. Okay. Now, if all that makes sense, and then you start reading Exodus 1, this Pharaoh who gets super nervous. I mean, you've had centuries since Joseph saved Egypt from famine. But you've got a guy who's like, hey, these people who haven't always been treated really well, that aren't native to us, could side with our enemies, and they're in our borders, and then we lose the northern kingdom again. So we've got to squelch them. We've got to keep them down. So if we start throwing dates on there, at the very bottom, 1876 is when Jacob and his family entered Egypt. 1526 is approximately when Moses was born. And Moses' life, as you know, is broken down into 40-year chunks. So 40 years after his birth, he flees to Midian. 40 years after that, God calls him back. So 80 years later is approximately when the Exodus would have taken place. 40 years after that is when the conquest of Canaan approximately would have started. And in the historical record, what you start seeing in the Egyptian language and in the Egyptian writing are some references to what looks like the Hebrew. You have some people referred to as the Shashu or the Apiru that are living in Canaan and starting to show up in Canaan according to Egyptian sources. Well, that fits. That fits the timeline. So, we're not going to start every lesson this way with a lot of history and chronology and timelines, but I think it helps to set the context for Moses' life. All right. And then someone did something really cute. I like it. I like the graphic, although the colors they chose are kind of washed out. Right. So again, if you got this and printed this out, it'd look great on a single sheet of paper. But it's someone with what's called the Bible Book Club that did a timeline of Moses' life and broke it down into three segments. So the upper segment, that peach, is the five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and just a hint of Joshua. Okay? And then in the green below that, you have geographic locations. Where was this history taking place? So you've got Egypt, travel out of Egypt, Mount Sinai, wandering in the wilderness, and then the plains of Moab. And then obviously with Joshua, you get into the conquest of Canaan. And then in the blue line below that, you have time frames given. So as you wrap up Genesis and get into Exodus, when you tie up the time that includes Jacob's family prior to that, you've got about 400 years in the land. You've got 2 months of travel, 11 months at Mount Sinai, approximately 38 and a half years wandering in the wilderness, 7 months in the plains of Moab getting ready to go in, and then after that, you've got the conquest of Canaan. And then you've got those markers of 1446 BC and 1406 BC, that 40-year chunk at the very, very bottom. Does that make sense? And again, you guys can get copies of this and print this out, or you can find this online. I wish they had more charts, but I think it's a mom who makes these just for fun, and so she's only done like 10. I wish she had about 100, but bless her for what she's doing. So now that we've set that context, a little bit of background, let's talk about the deliverer's birth. Exodus chapter 1. Okay, and we'll try to work through the text about a paragraph at a time. I've got my Bible open there. Starting in verse 1 and going through about verse 7, we have some introduction and the biblical context setting up the Exodus. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. All right, so God brought them in. Hundreds of years take place, and the population expands. That's all the text says. But then you get to what it explains about the politics and the oppression that came with that Pharaoh, starting in verse 8. Now, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And depending on who you read, you're going to see all kinds of names about which Pharaoh that is. Like, just last weekend, there was the homeschool convention at Duke Energy in Cincinnati. And our team was there. We had a booth. People know that we traveled to Egypt. And so I get asked the question a lot, which Pharaoh do you think it is? Well, which Pharaoh do you think it is? Yeah, do you hear a theme in like my Bible class? I put it back on them. So you tell me. You've obviously got a strong opinion about this. You tell me. And there was one gentleman last weekend. Well, I know the exact one, and his name was Ba Ba Ba, and he lived from here to here, and I even know Moses' Egyptian name. It was Ba Ba, like this whole thing. And I was like, wow, you know a lot. I'm glad you're confident about that. Like, I've got a time range. The point is, we've got a range. It fits. It can fit the history, even if we don't know the king. Don't get hung up on that, okay? And be humble and patient, because everyone thinks they know the king, and they don't always match, okay? But there was a king, likely one of the southern kings that has unified the kingdom, who did not know Joseph. And he said in verse 9 to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us." So add to the fact, they're reigning from southern Egypt. The Israelites are in northern Egypt. Like, if you get something out of control, it's going to take time. It's going to be hard to get them under control. So verse 10, "Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." So it's not just that they'll help the enemies win. He's afraid that he's going to lose this population because they've been working them. We're going to lose this workforce. Okay? "Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So you have the beginning of this oppression described, the oppression of Pharaoh. And there are words, like years ago, someone introduced the inductive study Bible to me, and I loved it. It was so much fun to write my own headings in my own paragraph, and I love it. But one of the things they really drilled was looking for repeated words, repeated phrases, things like that to help figure out what is the text trying to communicate. I love that. One of the things that's emphasized through this chapter is the multiplication of the people. It keeps talking about multiply, multiply, multiply. And the idea of fear. The idea of fear is emphasized. The Egyptians are in dread of the people. But through the course of this, you'll see that other people are living in fear of God. So there's a contrast there. They were in dread of the people of Israel. So he comes up with a great idea. Verse 13. They ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and make their lives bitter. That word bitter is important through the story of the Exodus. Eventually, the Passover meal is going to have an element in it to help them remember how bitter their time was. Made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and bricks and all kinds of work in the field, and in all their work they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. It's really bad. It's not as bad as it's going to get. Verse 15, then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, you shall kill him, but if it's a daughter, she shall live. I want you to think about what he's saying to do there for just a second. You know, here in the West, the way we work births typically and the way they portray them in movies is we go to the classes, right? We pack the bag, we get it by the door, someone's water breaks or their contractions get too close, people freak out, they jump in the car, they race to the ER, they get to the hospital, she gets admitted, they give birth in the hospital, baby recovers, mom recovers, usually for less than 24 hours, and then they come home, right? That is not what's being described here. What's being described here is a home birth where the midwife is coming to the home of the woman who's about to deliver, and the midwife and possibly a doula are overseeing the process. And what the Pharaoh is saying is, you're the first one that's going to figure out the gender of the child. And so when that baby comes out, before you present it to the parents, if it's a boy, kill it somehow and make it look like it just died during birth. Is essentially what he's asking them to do. That's horrible. And I'm going to step on a soapbox here for a second. I just am. The Word of God values the sanctity of human life because humans are created in the image of God, and they take on the value of that image at conception. And so those little people, those little image bearers, have value. The value is inherent. And even though these women might not have said it the way that I just said it, they believed that. That it was life, and that life had value. Okay? I'll step off that soapbox. I might get back on it later. Okay? No, I'm going to get back on it right now. Let me emphasize the idea of the inherent value of life as an image bearer, just for a second. Y'all are going to get so sick and tired of hearing my stories, right? I'm the father of 6 kids, 4 biological, 2 adopted. The youngest 2 are adopted. 2 of my 6 kids have already passed away. They're in heaven. My oldest son is Keenan. He's 20. He's about to get his AA down at FC. We're going down next week. We're super excited for him. 2 years after Keenan was born, we had a son named Cooper. 2 years after Cooper, we had a son named Whitaker. Both of those boys have passed. They were special needs boys. Each of them had their own unique flavor of special needs. One was autistic and epileptic, and the other one had cerebral palsy, and he also had epilepsy. And notice that I said they had, not were. They had those things. And those little boys, even though they had physical abilities or lack of abilities, still retained the inherent value of being an image bearer of God. Now, someone with a secular mindset would look at those boys and say they have less value because they have less capacity. They're actually a greater burden. And in some ways, they're not wrong about that. Like, there were some things, Whitaker could not chew his own food. He could not walk. If he went from place to place, it's because my wife picked him up off the floor and put him in a wheelchair and pushed him, and then she held him in her lap as she fed him food that she had made and put through a handmill 3 times a day. And she did that so that his weak muscles would be able to swallow that on his own. Before he took on to nursing, she had to feed him by pumping and using an eyedropper because that's all he could do. That takes extra time. And it takes extra effort. Is that more burden? Yeah. But they're worth it because they have inherent value as an image bearer of God, right? So as you have conversations with people at school or work or whatever, or as people are making decisions about policy, image bearers of God have inherent value because God gave them that value. Whether their capacity is what you think it ought to be or not. And let me jump to the other side of that spectrum for just a minute. Man, I'm soapboxing all over the place. As we age, as we get older, you know, we hit our peak, and then what do you know? We start getting weaker. And there's less hair up top. Like, that started with 20. Thanks a lot. But you get weaker. Your eyesight gets dim. You start losing teeth. Joints start to fail. Other things start to fail. Guess what? Your capacity, your physical capacity, is diminishing. But your inherent value as a being created in the image of God is the same. In some ways, as you age and your capacity decreases, if you're a child of God, I would argue that your value increases. Because you are more and more able to reflect that. You think about what Paul says over in 2 Corinthians. You know, we're in jars of clay that break down and get busted, but we're renewed every day. All right, so anyway, coming back to Exodus. These little babies had value, inherent value, because they were created in the image of God. And these midwives understood that on some level. And so they were not going to do what Pharaoh told them to do. We talked about how fear is a theme through chapter 1. Verse 17, the midwives feared God. The one that they feared was the Lord. So they did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this? And let them live." And the midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous, and they give birth before the midwife comes to them." You know, they go into labor and they're just there. What are you going to do? Like, I'm being silly, but that's what they're saying. And the Egyptian women take forever. And Pharaoh doesn't argue with them. He's like, "I don't need to know about that. I just know that it's not getting done." So it focuses on what God did for the midwives. Verse 20, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very strong. Because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Just really quick, I was in an adult class going through Exodus 1, where someone was talking about the morality of the women lying. Because that was not true. Okay? Just because the Bible records what someone said doesn't mean it's giving approval to the morality of what they said. Just because they were deceptive doesn't mean that God approves of deception. Don't use this as an excuse to be like, "Well, I can lie and God will just..." Don't do that. Okay? But there is an underlying thing here, and that is on the topic that had the most import from the story, is they had greater fear for the Lord, more awe for God, and they were preserving life. And so that's what the text focuses on. If you want to know what the Bible says about lying, there are so many other passages that deal with that. Don't use this one. Does that make sense? Okay. So Pharaoh had to come up with another solution to his population problem. Verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. And the Egyptian people worshipped the Nile. They had a high regard for the Nile. You know, what we see as the Nile today is not what they saw as the Nile back then, even geographically. The Nile is much more silted in. It doesn't flood to the same degree. They've dammed it up in certain places. But back during the time of Moses, like, it flooded on a regular basis. It flooded the basin. It made things fertile. It made it easy to grow. When they talked about how they could water their fields by pressing their foot, the Bible talks about that. They could. I mean, it was so fine, they could push down into the ground with their foot and water would come up and they'd plant stuff. And so they relied on that cyclical flooding of the Nile, and they worshiped the Nile and the animals that were in the Nile, and they're pitching the Hebrew boys into the Nile. Now, I don't know at what age they were supposed to do that. I kind of think, like, as soon as they were born, they were supposed to. That's not specified. It's just the boys are supposed to get thrown in. And then we get to chapter 2. Let's catch that up. Verse 1, now a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch, and she put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. There's so much about that. Like, man, I want to have a conversation with her. I want to talk with her about that. Right? She has people in her life who have lost their sons. She just does. And I'm sure at the birth of every child, everyone's holding their breath. Is this going to be a girl or a boy? And when it's a girl, they just go, oh. And when it's a boy, they're like, oh. And they get tense because they know what they're going to have to do. Like, there's just some tension over that. And so she's tense, her husband's tense, Moses is born, he's a boy. And what are you going to do? And they hide him for 3 months. That had to be a super stressful 90 days. Like, how do you hide the arrival of a kid? They cry. They make noise. Everyone knows you were pregnant, and then all of a sudden you're not. So where's the child? And so for 3 months, there's this stress of trying to preserve this child's life. And there's something interesting. I don't know what all to make about it, but in verse 2, one of the reasons that they preserved his life is it says they saw he was a fine child. I don't think that just means physically. I would love to say that every child is a beautiful baby. They're not. And don't ask me to look at your baby pictures and tell you. Like, some babies are super cute and some grow into it. I don't think that's what the text is describing about him. But whatever the quality that they saw in him, it's repeated in Hebrews 11. Because in Hebrews 11, when the Hebrew writer is talking about all of these people who live lives of faith, and they're giving you case after case after case of lives of faith, when it gets to the life of Moses, who gets the most amount of Hebrews 11, it starts with the faith of his parents. That by faith, they preserved his life because they saw he was a handsome child. I think, this is just my think, okay? This is hypothetical. The text doesn't say this. I think it implies it. I wonder if they saw something about his potential and his connection with all of this, or hoped for it, and that's why. I just wonder that they saw something about him, and they're like, who knows what he's going to do? Who knows what he's going to be? Who knows? Who knows? And so we've got to save him. I think that's more the sense of it than he's got grandfather Yosef's eyes. Like, I don't think that was it. Now you keep going, and they put him in the river. So if someone says, hey, did you guys have a boy? Yep. What'd you do with him? We put him in the river. In a basket. that's floating right there, but we put them in the river. I mean, they could honestly say, we put them in the Nile. I think they're playing word games, but look, they're trying to preserve his life. And I don't know if their plan was to put him there and come back. I suspect they knew that Potiphar's daughter or Pharaoh's daughter was going there. I suspect they knew that. It wasn't the first time she took a bath. And they stake out Miriam so they don't leave Moses unattended. Someone in the family is watching. So when you get to verse 4, his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her young women walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her servant woman, and she took it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the child was crying. And she took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children. And he's a boy. And he's not drowned. What should she do?" She should flip the basket over and walk away. It's what she should do. But she didn't. She took mercy on this boy. The sister, Miriam, verse 7, runs up and says to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you? Hey, I happen to know a lady that, you know, could use some relief and take care of a baby right now. Like, she could be here in 30 minutes. I'm not going to tell you that it's his mom, but..." And that's what she did. Verse 8, Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." She's getting paid to take care of her own son. Like, how sweet is that gig? Every mother in the room is like, "Where do I sign up for that?" But, verse 10, when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses because she said, "I drew him out of the water." Moses' mother has got limited time with him. She's got more than her friends have had. But she takes care and teaches him so much. Moses knew who he was, and he knew where he came from, and that was by God's providence. Not only was he spared, but he was taken care of. His mom was taken care of. Their household was taken care of. And Moses grew up knowing who he was. So even though he was in Pharaoh's house and he had all the privileges and all the blessings of royalty, he knew, "I am a Hebrew and those are my people." He knew. And he had that in his head working on him for 40 years. Now we're going to talk about that more later, but I want to fill in this chart. So in Exodus 2, 1 through 3, you have the faith of the parents. In 2, 4 through 10, you've got the provision of God. Now, the Bible verse that we read for the reading before the sermon was Deuteronomy 18, 15. And we're going to be doing this all week. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brothers, and it is him you shall listen." It is to him you shall listen. Deuteronomy is the final five sermons of Moses before he dies. All 120 years of his life have been fulfilled. And so he's giving them his final encouragements, his final instructions. He reviews the Exodus. He reviews the deliverance. Everything that God has done. And it's like his parting shot. Guys, do right. And in the midst of all that, a couple of times specifically in Deuteronomy 18, he prophesies that at some point way in the future, God's going to raise up another prophet. And in many ways, he's going to be like Moses. And when that man shows up, listen to him. And so all through Israel's history, they're like, "Is he the next Moses? Is he the next Moses? Well, where's the next Moses? I don't know. Who's the next Moses?" And what I'm going to be saying all week long is, throughout the Gospels, Jesus is proving to the Israelites, "I'm the next Moses. Pay attention." Right? So, this is another, I wish I had made it bigger, but it's a timeline of the story of the Bible is what someone has called it. So even in the green, way back in the green, you've got Moses. You've got Joshua at 1406 starting to go into the land. But when you get up into the red, right in the middle, you've got the cross underneath it. You've got the arrival of Jesus in history. And you've got his birth around 4 or 5 BC. Okay? And I want you to think about Jesus' birth. And I'm going to summarize a lot of this because you're familiar with it, but the texts are going to be up on the screen. In Matthew chapter 1 and also in Luke, Luke does this with the lineage of Jesus, you're introduced to the lineage of Jesus, all of the forefathers that led up to his arrival and all of the connections that fulfilled prophecy, but then you have Jesus show up in a very specific time and place in history. And several of the Gospels do that. Matthew does it really well, emphasizing his royal lineage. Luke does it really well, landing him in the historical context, is what Luke is trying to do. And so you have an introduction to the life of Jesus. But then in Matthew chapter 2, especially the first 12 verses, you're introduced to this character, Herod the Great, and the oppression of Herod the Great. When he realizes a king has been born, he's a competitor to me reigning. Who is this king? And he tries to get these wise men to reveal the location of this child who's been born under the pretext of, oh, I want to worship him, but really he wants to kill him. So you have the oppression of Herod. And just like Moses' parents, you have the faith of Jesus' parents. You have the faith of Jesus' parents emphasized even before his birth. Over in Luke chapter 1, Mary is told that she's going to have a child without having intimacy with a man. That's not how mom explained it. And not just any child, but she's going to have God's child. And by faith, she submits. By faith, she submits to that. Joseph realizes that she is pregnant and it's not his. And he loves her so much that he's not going to fulfill the law and have her stoned and cast out. He's just not going to follow through with the marriage until it's revealed to him, hey, this is of the Lord, marry her. And by faith, he does it. And he adopts a child who is not his. By faith. You see the faith of his parents emphasized time and time again. Luke chapter 2 also emphasizes that. What's really neat is if you ever get the opportunity to go on a trip to Israel, there's the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, and that's the hallway leading up to the focal point. The pillars are really, really old. It's not the original floor. That floor is above the original floor. The hole that you see there is actually a couple of trap doors that they flip open so you can look down and see the mosaics. But what's significant is you get to the end of that hall, and you have this little area. This church building is still an active worship site. There are several different groups that take care of it and use it every single day, and especially on weekends. So you see a couple sitting in the chairs, all the ornamentation on the ceiling. To me, the neatest thing about this place is the basement. Because underneath that place is a cave, and I'll show a picture of it in just a little bit, where it's more than likely that the folks who lived there originally kept their animals in the cave. It was their barn. You know, when we talk about Jesus being born in a barn and we have this cutesy little red thing with white trim, and like, that's a Western, Midwestern barn. That is not what Jesus was born in. In Bethlehem, it was more than likely one of the caves in the hills. And he was placed in a manger. It was not a wood, cute manger. It was a stone manger, because that's what mangers were made out of back then. They were carved out of the stone and lasted a long, 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 long time. And so because of the faith of his parents, when the census was taken and they needed to travel south, they showed up and went into that place and placed the newborn Jesus there. But then when you're in Matthew chapter 2, verses 13 through 15, Joseph and Mary are made aware that Herod the Great is trying to get Jesus. He's trying to kill him. He's trying to get at him. And so what they're instructed to do is they're instructed to flee to Egypt. You need to go hide out in Egypt for a little bit, because it's prophesied, out of Egypt I will call my son. And so Jesus, and in his infancy, is connected with the Exodus. That Jesus is going to go through a form of the Exodus that the Israelites went through, which is what we're reading about right now. But in a different sequence, as you keep looking through the Gospels, and you've got that map of the route that they think they took. If you keep going in the text, when Herod is afraid that Jesus has gotten away, he issues a similar order to Pharaoh: kill the boys. It's not all the Israelites, it's the boys under a certain age in that little spot of Bethlehem. Sound really similar to Moses? And in that cave underneath that church building in Bethlehem is what is called the Cave of the Innocents, because in that cave they found several small infant-sized sepulchers with the remains of boys that date to about the first century. But because of the warning by God through the angels, Jesus is brought back out of Egypt and his parents take him up to Nazareth and he's raised a Nazarene. We're looking for the next Moses. Who's the next Moses? It's Jesus. Jesus is the next Moses. Now, we're going to be doing this all week, and hopefully you're going to start to see connections, and you're going to start sharing, hey, is this a connection too? And I'll probably say, yeah, that's a connection too. But let's make some application really quick, okay? Let's emphasize some things that we can take away and use. The first thing is this. Every deliverer God raised up pointed to our ultimate deliverer, Jesus. Like, Moses is amazing. All these things are written about Moses. But he just typifies and foreshadows our need for Jesus, because Moses was not Jesus. Moses was not perfect. Moses made mistakes, and we're going to talk about that this week. The other thing that we can notice between the two is that God is providentially working through history to accomplish his redemptive plan. And he plays the long game. We need to be patient and trust him. We are such an impatient people, and I lump myself into that too. There are things that we go through. We are constantly living between the promise and the fulfillment of God's word. I live in a tension between the two. And I live it by faith. And I don't know when the fulfillment is going to come. Like, I look forward to the return of Jesus. I don't know when that's going to be. I believe it's going to happen. But the promise has been made, and here's the fulfillment, and here I am. And I don't know which part of that I'm in. I just know I'm in the middle of it. And it feels like forever sometimes. But by faith, that's where we live. And we need to trust that God's at work. We kind of did this with the soapbox moment. The life of every child is precious to God and should be to us as well. And I'm going to add just one more thing in there that I didn't think to add when I was younger, but it needs to be said, and it needs to be said more often. Children have inherent value as image bearers of God, regardless of the circumstances of their birth. Children don't choose to be born, and they don't get to choose under the circumstances by which their mother becomes pregnant. But regardless of those circumstances, those children have inherent value, and they need to be told that. And they need to be treated that way. Because culture will make them question their value if their birth isn't squeaky clean and perfect. Okay? So the life of every child is precious to God and should be to us as well. And especially for us as parents, we need to follow the example of these parents and live by faith, no matter the personal cost. Joseph and Mary had to sacrifice a lot and then take their son and raise him in the middle of nowhere, right? Moses' parents were running the risk of being punished with death, but they thought that risk was worth it. Okay, we need to set the example for our kids and live lives of faith, no matter what the personal cost may be, if we want to help them live the same way. That was a lot, and you all have been super patient. Thank you for all of that. If there's any part of this lesson that has convicted you, encouraged you, and you need prayers, we would like to offer that to you. You know, we're getting to the point of tying in the gospel. We didn't specifically do that today. But if Jesus really is the second Moses, we need to listen to him, and that means becoming one of his disciples. Okay, so we're going to talk about that the more we go this week. If there's any way that we can be an encouragement to you this morning, come to the front as we stand and sing.